Hockey Hall of Famer Clark Gillies with us, of course, Regina Pats Memorial Cup champion and Stanley Cup champion with the New York Islanders. And, of course, a line mate with someone we had a few weeks ago, Brian Trotche. But, Clark, you're on stage singing The Gambler with Brian Trotche. How many times did the acoustic guitar come out in your days in New York and you guys would just be singing tunes maybe in the hotel room late at night?
Well, you know, we saved that stuff for special occasions, and fortunately the special occasions were every time we had a Stanley Cup party, Trotch would bring the guitar and we'd get up and do some of the same shtick that you saw in Regina a couple of years ago. So, we have a lot of fun. Trotch and I are actually, we take that little routine on the road now. Whenever we do, we played up at Dakota Dunes up in Saskatoon. Chief Darcy Bear had heard about Trotz and I and our antics, so he said, "Would you guys come up play golf for a couple of days with some of our customers and then do a little thing at a party one night?" And we said, "Hell yeah!" So we ended up having a full band. That was a really good one. Trotz, there was a bunch of native guys that had a band. They were great. They were awesome. Trotch played along with them. We set up. We were like a professional group. It was sweet. So we do that quite often on the road. And usually we go to Mario Lemieux's fantasy camp every year down in Pittsburgh. And Trotch and I, and actually Theron Fleury gets up and does a few tunes. And we have a blast with it. So we're working on some new material that we haven't released yet, you know?
Whoa. Is there an album coming out, Clark? What's going on?
I don't know about an album. The only thing we're going to sing is other people's songs. So, we got to be careful what we steal, you know?
Well, do you have Trio Grande as a band name? Would Mike Bossy ever join you on stage?
Boss is not an entertainer, unfortunately. But, he refuses to get up and sing. It's his loss. You know, he misses out on a lot of stuff, but Brian and I get such a kick out of it. And, we've done everything from a bunch of Elvis songs to Willin' and Whaley.
Willie and Whalen.
And Willie. Whalen and Willie. I just gave him a new name. there's lots of good stuff. But like I said, we're kind of country boys at heart, so we get a kick out of doing that stuff.
On that line that I mentioned, did you ever try to make Mike Bossy an honorary Saskatchewanian with you two, one from Swift Current and one from Moose Jaw?
He's about the furthest thing from a Saskatchewanian that you're going to find. I mean, it's a Ukrainian kid grew up in Quebec, so I don't know. That's a bad mix to start with. And he's a big city kid from Montreal. We don't get him out west too often. He gets a little antsy when he gets too far from home anyway. So he wouldn't fit into our western style very well. I don't think I've ever seen him wear a pair of cowboy boots. So that kind of tells you the story with him. But we have a lot of fun with Boss too. We did a couple of gigs with him two summers ago. One was in Winnipeg and we did a golf outing, then we did another corporate thing. We had a good time. It was Trotz and I were doing most of the work while Boss sat back and looked pretty, you know. So, but we get that group together every once in a while, the Trio Grande, and reminisce a little bit. I enjoyed playing with those guys. They were pretty easy, and my job was pretty simple. You know, get my ass on a couple in front of the net and then make sure that they were well taken care of as far as some of the other people on the ice. And it turned out pretty well for me, so I can't complain.
Clark, you're a household name around Saskatchewan. Even in Regina, you play for the Regina Pats. But some people don't know that you had a budding baseball career where you spent some time down in Covington, Virginia, in the Appalachian Baseball League. Can you bring us back to that experience? What was that like down there? I think you went down there when you were 16 years old.
Yeah. Interesting story. I was playing for the, I think they were called, well, the Regals, Moose Jaw, I think they were called the Devons at that time. and I missed the tournament up in Lacombe. And Ned Andreoni was our coach, and he was doing a little bit of scouting for Houston, and a couple of the Houston guys were up in Lacombe and said, any young kids down there we should take a look at? And he said, yeah, well, we got this kid, Clark Gillies. He couldn't make the trip, but I think he might be worth taking a look at. So they came down a couple of days later, and I had a tryout down at Roswell's Park. And at that time, I was a catcher, so they had me throwing balls into a pail at second base, and which I don't think I missed the pail once, which was kind of nice. And then they had me taking ground balls and then running in the outfield, catching fly balls, and, of course, batting. And it seemed like everything I batted that day went out of the ballpark. So they were, needless to say, impressed, and we went up the street. We lived a couple of blocks up the street from the ballpark, and my mom and I sat in the kitchen while my dad and Ned Andreoni and the two scouts, one of them, who happened to be Pat Gillick, who went on to have a tremendous baseball career in management. Pat was one of the, was the head scout, another guy by the name of Eddie Matthews. Anyway, long story short, they talked for about 15 minutes, and my dad comes in the kitchen and said, they want to talk to you. And I go, okay. So he says, they want to sign you to a baseball contract. And I go, well, what the hell does that mean? He says, well, they're going to give you a signing bonus for $5,000. I was like, kidding, right? $5,000? What for? And they're going to pay you $500 a month. I said, well, that's not a bad deal. I was making about $300 a month out of the airbase, stocking shelves and working my butt off. So the playing baseball and getting $500, actually U.S., wasn't too bad at that time. I said, so, all right, let's do it. So I was off to Covington, Virginia, and first time ever away from home, first time on an airplane. I got down there with a bunch of Puerto Rican. There were a bunch of black guys on the team, a bunch of Puerto Ricans, which I had never seen. I've only seen one black guy in my life, and that was Roosevelt Seeley, who was wide receiver for our high school football team in Moose Jaw. And, you know, a bunch of college baseball players that were pretty cocky. And I was like, I'm not really sure I belong here, you know. But I adjusted. The first year was tough. I was homesick as hell. Adjusted pretty well. Came back the next year with a different attitude. And it was nice. So, you know, 2.5 years of instructional baseball, getting professional teaching from the coaches and scouts and that from Houston Astros turned me into a much better ball player. But after a couple of years there, they said to me, you know, we know you love playing hockey and looks like you love baseball. I said, no, I love them both. But they said, we need you to make a decision. And I said, well, thanks for the opportunity, but I think I want to be a hockey player. And they said, well, we kind of see the hockey player in you, because when I was a catcher, I used to love hitting people when they came around, came into home plate. So they said, you know what, we understand. It was a good investment on our part, but you want to go a different direction, that's fine. So that was it. I was... I guess after that summer, I was going into my last year with the Pats. No, maybe my second year with the Pats. Yeah, second year with the Pats. And I had blossomed that summer from 195 to 220 and never looked back from there. I hate to say I'm not 220 anymore, but it's more like 230, but I feel good. And that was a great time in my life. It was, I missed, the other thing I missed, which I couldn't play because I was playing baseball. They said, we're not going to let you play football in the wintertime. And I was the quarterback. I loved playing football. I loved playing defense too, but I loved being quarterback. And that was part of my high school, the high school fun that I'll never get back. And I kind of wish I could have done that too. But it was, like I said, it was a great experience. And I'm certainly glad I chose the path that I did, that's for sure.
Clark, did your time in the Appalachian League impact your success for the Islanders in any way? Like, what did you learn down there that benefited you later on?
That's a good question. Nobody ever asked me that. I suppose taking instructions well, maybe. Appreciating the people that I was working with. I had a lot of great coaches in Moosha, and I owe them nothing but a deep debt of gratitude as I was growing up. But when I got to the past, I had my first coach was Earl Ingerfield, and he was a tremendous help to my career. He's the one that actually said to me, I met him actually, didn't be telling stories out of school, but I met him at Billy Hickey's bar in downtown Regina. He said, come down there. Billy and I went to talk to you. So went in there and had a couple of beers. And he said, I just want to tell you something you're not even sure how good you are. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you have the opportunity kind of right on your, sitting in your lap right now. He said, you can be an NHL hockey player. You can skate, you can shoot, you can score. He said, you're tough as nails. He said, there's a spot on every NHL roster for you. He said, but all you got to do is take care of yourself and apply yourself. And I'll never forget that meeting that day, because up until that point, I was just a big happy-go-lucky kid that was, playing a game that I absolutely loved and didn't really think about the NHL that much, to be honest with you. When I went to Regina, I was just enjoying myself and doing the thing that I'd always done my whole life. And Earl kind of flicked the light on and said, there's a career here for you if you really apply yourself, which I think I did. And it all turned out well. But I think being away from home too, I left home when I was 16 years old, and basically, I get go away from baseball, I come back, and I was in Regina, so I wasn't living at home from the time I was 16 on. So it helped me grow up a little bit, make me probably more of a man, more responsible, let's say. And like I said, I think I've always been a pretty good student and did everything my coaches asked me to do and was a good listener and paid attention to everything they said. So that's always been one of my traits that I don't think you can find too many coaches that had a problem with me not applying myself and being a good leader on a team. But that is a very good question. I think maturity is probably the biggest thing. When I went down there, I was by myself and I had to fend for myself, and it made me grow up in a lot of ways.
Clark Gillies with us, Hockey Hall of Famer from Moose Jaw, former Regina Pat Stanley Cup champion with the New York Islanders. You were drafted by the Islanders, but you're also drafted by the WHA Edmonton Oilers. Was there ever any thought to stay closer to home and play in the WHA?
Not really. My agent at that time, out of Montreal, passed away shortly after that. I said I really want to play in the NHL. But if Edmonton wants to pay me, I don't know. If Edmonton wants to pay me, let's say I don't know what the number was. But if it was worthwhile, I would have gone to play in Edmonton, probably. But the Islanders ended up offering more money at that time, and obviously it was an NHL team and not a WHA team. And I wasn't really sure, what the future of the WHA was at that time. So my first and probably only choice through the whole thing was going to the Islanders and the NHL. But I guess a few years later, I might have got an opportunity to play with Gretzky. But I don't think that would have been any better than playing with Trotsky and Bossy and Potvin. But yeah, it was an interesting time. I didn't know Bill Hunter, I guess, was the guy that was running the Oilers at that time, and I never got a call really from anybody there to try and convince me to come there. So I guess I didn't pay much attention to what was going on, and then ultimately ended up getting offered less money to go there anyway. So, and again, it turned out to be a pretty good decision, not going to Edmonton and going to the Islanders. So.
Did
but
you?
Yeah, that was. I was. Somebody was asking me about that draft, and I said, "Did you do research on that? There wasn't even a real. I don't know if it was actually a real draft or not. I don't know. I never dug too deep into it, but it wasn't something. It wasn't anything like the NHL draft. I think it was just sort of kind of pick whoever you want at that time. But anyway, long story short, Islanders were very, very good to me, and glad I made that decision.
Did you have Brian Trottier talk to us about being homesick too? When Tiger Williams got him back into the car and get him there. Did you have as tough a transition with that aspect of it, of being in New York City? Brian's, of course, was more to do with the Swift Current Broncos than it was the NHL, but what was the transition like to be in the Big Apple?
Well, you know, I was much older at that time, and you know, our training camp that year was up in Peterborough, Ontario. And we had our last exhibition game was in Ottawa. And camp broke that night. I got up the next morning and I was in the back seat of an old 98 convertible. Ralph Stewart owned the car, and this guy Craig Cameron was in the front, and I was in the back. And off we go from Ottawa. We drove down to Long Island. And my first experience of New York, and I really didn't know what to expect, because the only thing I knew about New York was Kojak and Kelly Savalas, right? So we pulled down. We came down the Major Deegan Expressway and got to the George Washington Bridge. And now we got to get on the Cross Island Expressway to go over to the Frog's Neck Bridge. I know all these names now, but I didn't know them then. And we drove through the Bronx. And this is back in the early 70s. There was a lot of rioting and stuff back in the 70s. A lot of these buildings along the Cross Island Parkway were all burnt out brick buildings. And it was a pretty nasty looking place. And I'm sitting in this convertible. It is hot. It's probably, I don't know, 90 degrees. Hot, sticky. I was like, oh boy, is this what this place is like? And then we crossed over the Throg's Neck Bridge, and it burst into this beautiful suburban area with, you know, multi-million-dollar homes and beautiful water views. And I said, this is a little bit more like what I expected getting here. But it was a real eye opener when I first really saw it. New York and that area was the Bronx, and it was pretty rough at that time. But I quickly found out that, you know, Long Island is, you know, for the most part, it's just a bigger version of, like, say, Regina. You know, Regina was the big city to me back in Saskatchewan, you know, growing up in Moose Jaw. So it was really just nothing more than suburban living. We got used to it quick. My wife, Pam, who I've known her since, you know, the ninth grade, she came down that year, and we got married the following summer. And she's the one, she said to me, she said, this is beautiful here. Why don't we buy a house here if you're going to play here? And I said, yeah, we can do that. So we've had a house here since 1975, summer of 1975, I bought the house, and I've lived in multiple houses since then. But yeah, we've really settled in here right from the beginning, and it's absolutely beautiful here. So, you know, did I miss the jaw? Yeah, but we used to go home the first few years. We went home in the summertime for, you know, a month, 5 weeks, and we would see everybody, and then as we had children, it got a little tougher. So we would bring them home and rent a place for a month or so. But I don't get back too often. I haven't been home in a couple of years, back to Regina. Certainly talk to my brother and my sister all the time. But I just don't get back there as often as I'd like to. And now with the borders being closed, it's made it impossible. So I was supposed to be at a sports dinner up in Delisle with Trot, speaking of Trot, August or July 12th or August 12th. I forget what it was. But they canceled that, obviously. So it's really cut down a lot of my travel. I've been home, basically home here since March 10th when they shut everything down. Haven't been into my office in almost almost 4 months now, I guess. And the one thing I have done is get a lot of golf in over the last two or three months. Not getting any better, but certainly playing a lot. But it's it was a bit of a getting back to the original question. It was a bit of a transition. This place it's big. I mean, we have 5 million people living on Long Island, so not hard to bump into somebody. Tough getting used to the road system, finding my way around, but all those things were just part of just part of growing up, I guess, and. We are still here. We haven't. This is our 46th year on Long Island, and other than a brief 3-year visit to Buffalo at the end of my career, but we moved back here and have no regrets. I've got one child, one daughter lives here. He's got 3 grandkids, 2 boys and a girl. My second oldest daughter lives in Boston. She's got 2 boys and a girl, and my youngest daughter. Brianna, who is married to Bobby Bourne's son Justin, they have a little boy and a new little girl. She's only 3 months old. We haven't seen her yet, which is kind of disturbing. But everything, life is good. I can't complain.
Clark, your relationship with Bob Bourne, this is a bizarre thing to me. You played hockey in Saskatchewan, one for the Blades, one for you for the Pats. Then you both played. Right. In Covington, in the Appalachian Baseball League. Then you both end up on the Islanders, and somehow your kids marry each other. Like, you've been bonded for life for almost your entire existence.
Don't remind me. God. Yeah, Bourne and I are kind of connected at the hip, you might say. I played against him in the South Saskatchewan Baseball League, and then we ended up playing junior hockey against each other. And then, lo and behold, I'm down in Covington, and all of a sudden I see him walk in the door. I'm like, what the hell? You following me around? What's going on? And we played a couple of years of baseball, 3 years of junior hockey against each other. And then it was kind of like, after we left baseball and we knew that we're the last season, and we're like, this might be over. Our romance might be over, Bourne. You're probably going to get drafted by somebody else, and I'll get drafted by somebody, and we'll never see each other again unless we're on the ice. And lo and behold, he got drafted by Kansas City. Then before training camp started, Kansas City traded him to the Islanders for this guy, Bart Crashley. He was a decent defenseman. I guess they needed defense, so we got Bourne in the trade. I was like, holy Christ. I'm stuck with you for life. And then, obviously, we were great friends, and we ended up buying houses next to each other. Our wives really liked each other, and the kids were about the same age. And then we both left the Islanders at the same time in 1986. He got picked up on waivers. He went to L.A. I went to Buffalo. And the kids... they were only, Justin and Brianna were only, Justin was, I think he was 5, and I think Brianna was 6 then, something along those lines. And then they got back together when Bourne got inducted into the Islander Hall of Fame, fell in love over the weekend, dumped their boyfriends, dumped their girlfriends, and have been an item ever since, and got married about 3 years later, and now they have 2 beautiful kids, Charlie and Molly, and Bourne and I are grandpas together. So it's, I don't know if it's come full circle, but it's come a long ways. And I enjoy seeing him. I don't see him as much as I'd like to, but he's doing all right. He's out in Kelowna, British Columbia, living a life. absolutely beautiful out there. So, you know, we talk quite often, and see each other on occasion. But like I said, if we had an open border, we'd probably see more of each other. But it's just not working out right now. But yeah, it's interesting how life takes its different paths, and from not knowing each other to not being able to get away from each other. So, love having them in the extended family, and look forward to the day I see him again.
Clark Gillies with us. With the Islanders, before the Cup started to come in and winning four in a row, how hard was it to get over the hump of the Broad Street Bullies, the great Montreal Canadian teams, to finally hoist that cup?
At that time, when I got drafted 74, Philly was they were on the top of the heap, right? And won a couple of cups back to back. We had decent success against them. My rookie year, we went to the semifinals. We were down 3-0 and almost won in game 7. We lost 4-1, but we were down 3-0 against them, just like the previous series against Pittsburgh. We came back and beat Pittsburgh, and lo and behold, we were down 3-0 again and came back and pushed it to a 7th game. And if we beat the Flyers, we go to the Stanley Cup Finals against Buffalo. And we might have had a shot against Buffalo. I don't know. But anyway, it was a tough era. It was they were still the big bad Bullies, the Broad Street Bullies, and I didn't have much problem with them, but it was the one of the highlights and things that people talk about still to this day, 45 years later, is the fight that I had with Schultz in the 5th game in Philadelphia in that 1975 series. And I kind of won that one pretty decisively. And then we came back again. We won game 5 and we came back and won game 6 and then lost in the 7th game, and then they ended up winning that cup again. But that was a turning point for me, because Schultze, I love the guy. I think he's one of the great people in the world now. But back then, he was like, what a pain in the ass. Every time you get on the ice against him, he was like, he wanted to start something. And finally, it got to the point where it was a bit out in the open ice, and I kind of beat the crap out of him. But it was a turning point for our team. A lot of guys say, we've been pushed around for the first 3 years and we've been in the league, and now we got a guy like Clarkey who has changed the whole identity of our team. Because, we had some tough guys. Bobby Nystrom, Gary Howitt, myself. Our team was taking a whole new identity, and we could play. We were getting better. We could play, with Trotz and myself and Billy Harris and Denny Poppin all being first-round draft picks. And then a couple of years later, we get Bossy, and our team just started to improve. Like you said, we had to deal with that. That team, that Montreal team, from they won at 76 to 79. They were, I hate to use the word pretty to watch, but they were kind of what we wanted to be, but a little tougher version than what they were. And I think we kind of got that. I think we got there. Montreal had some toughness. Larry Robinson was sneaky tough because he was so big, but he had a long fuse. He's kind of like me, he didn't do much until people pissed him off. But they were very talented, and they played the game, the way I wanted to play. I knew I could fight, but I really wanted to play hockey properly. And playing against and watching these guys, you know, they're just their mental attitude about the game. They were never out of the game, regardless of the position they were in. And so that was a good experience for us, having to battle against them for 4 years until finally we got our shot in 1980. And I would arguably say that our team has really accomplished more than any other team in the league. I mean, when you talk about during that time winning 19 straight series to get to your 20th series, which would equate to your fifth cup in a row, I think that's pretty impressive. And we always have that. We have that notch in our belt, you know, regardless of whether we won the fifth cup or not. So very proud of our team and all the players on it and what we were able to accomplish.
Clark, speaking of accomplishments, this is an accomplishment of a different kind, but you are one of a handful of NHL players that can say that you posed in Penthouse magazine. How did this come about?
That was after, I guess that was after the third cup. Our PR guy comes in the locker room and he says, we just got a call from Penthouse. They want to do a layout featuring the three consecutive Stanley Cup winning New York Islanders. Is there anybody that would like to do it? You know, and if you can't give an answer now and have to go ask your wife, let us know. So I quickly said, I'll do it. And Nystrom goes, I'll do it. Gordy Lane goes, I'll do it. And Wayne Merritt goes, I'll do it. But I got to ask my wife first. So he was the only one that had to go home and ask his wife. Ultimately, he ended up doing it. We had such a good time with that. Done very, very classy. There was one picture. I guess there were a couple of pictures. She was laying on top of the locker stall. She didn't have much on in that picture. But we never, ever saw her. They did it very professionally. We were kind of told to, you know, not look. They'll set her up, and then we get in position and stuff. And then there was something in the shower, which was also done very professionally. But the one shoot that, I don't know if you have it in front of you, we did we were out on the ice in our underwear with our gloves and sticks and skates on, skating around. And one of the shots, they wanted to skate around, all come in at the same time. And, stop and throw some snow up on the blue line. And we did it time and time again. And we were still on the ice trying to get it right when the Pittsburgh Penguins, who we were playing them the next night, they had to practice at our practice rink because we had the Coliseum. So we're in the midst of doing this scene where we have to stop and throw snow up. And don't you know, they come back from practice and walk through the Zamboni entrance and see us assholes on the ice with no clothes on, basically. It was priceless. And there were guys in that team we knew, Andre Saint-Laurent, who I played with for about 4 or 5 years, Pat Price. There were a couple other guys on the team that I knew. And they were laughing, we were laughing. It was beautiful. It was like, but I have gotten so many people ask about that photo shoot, and it's kind of put us all on the map, to be honest with you. I think I get more people ask about that than they do what it was like to win the Stanley Cup, but a lot of fun. We had such a good time doing that thing. That was just part of, you know, one of the perks. Little simple little perk that you got from winning, and otherwise none of us would have been in Penthouse, that's for sure. But it was so much fun, and the outcome was classic. And I bought one of those magazines. You can buy those things online. They're more expensive now, of course, but I got my own copy of that, so it's kind of nice to show people every once in a while.
Clark Gillies.
Now with the internet, you don't need magazines. You go on Google and it's right there. So, you know.
Clark, we've done a lot of interviews, and locker room hijinks is usually a topic that comes up. Lindy Ruff got you once.
Can
you go through the range of emotions that day before you eventually got to your locker room?
That was my first day as a Buffalo Sabre. And I got on a plane about, 9:30, I guess, something like that. And I was on my way, leaving my wife and kids here in New York, and packed a bag of stuff I needed. And off I went, got on a plane here at LaGuardia, flew into Buffalo. Got some guy picked, I don't know who the guy was, picked me up at the airport. It wasn't like they picked me up in a limousine either. It was some guy, and I threw all my shit in the back of his car, and off we went. My whole ride to the practice rink was, do I really want to be here? Do I really want to be here? You know, because it was just the same old dismal Buffalo that I had seen, you know, playing there for 12 years, and none of us ever liked it. Anyways, we get there. I get practices already going on. So I go upstairs, and the trainer gives me my equipment and get on the ice probably about 20 minutes to half an hour late for the start of practice. And Scotty Bowman is the coach. Gets everybody here in a circle and like to welcome Clark to the group. And, you know, and I'm looking at all these guys that I've basically been beating the shit out of for the last 12 years. And they're like, how are they going to take me? You know, they don't know my personality. They don't know that I'm going to be the best teammate they ever had. They're going to have more fun with me around than they could ever have. But there's those variables. So I finished practice. We finished practice. I stayed on the ice. I did a little extra work just for what I missed at the beginning. And, I go upstairs, and I'm late. The bus is leaving. We're actually flying to Winnipeg. You know, if this wasn't bad enough, I had to go to Buffalo. Now I'm flying to Winnipeg for, you know, my first night on being on the team. And I love Winnipeg too. Don't get me wrong. So I shower. I come in. I go to put my pants on, and I'm like, I'm in a bad mood. I'm in a really bad mood. I'm like, oh God. Am I going to make it through this? Am I going to make it through this? So I start getting dressed, and I pull my pants up, and I'm trying to do up the zipper, and it gets stuck down, right? You figure you can manipulate it out of there eventually. Well, I couldn't get this goddamn zipper to open up, and I'm like, this is really starting to annoy me. Now I sit down and I'm getting ready. I'm actually getting ready to take another suit out of my bag and put it on because I can't get the zipper up on this one. And I look up, and Mike Ramsey and Lindy Ruff are crying in the other corner. They're crying, laughing. And I go, "You bastards! I can't believe you did this to me." And they go, "Welcome to the Sabres." And I go, "I was like, Lindy especially." I said, "Lindy," I said, "you and I are going to be friends because you are just like me." That's exactly what I would have done to a guy that came to the Islanders. And they said, "You got me hook, line, and sinker." And that was the real icebreaker, I can tell you. And I'm so glad that they did that to me that day because it just showed me that we're all the same. The players are all the same. We just wear different uniforms. And, you know, we represent the uniform, and we do whatever it takes to help that uniform or that team win. But deep down, we're all just, you know, knucklehead, love to play hockey at any cost type of guy. And they proved it to me that day. And those two guys, Mike Ramsey and Lindy Ruff, ended up being two of my best friends on that team. And a lot of it was to do with that day and their welcoming me with the zipper tie down, which I ended up doing to a couple other guys as they came to the team, like Wilf Paimon. I got Wilf Paimon with that one. I got Eddie Hospodar with that one. And, you know, just all in good fun. And we used to love that kind of stuff. So, you know.
Did you ever get Lindy back?
probably not. Because Lindy was one of the guys. He was like Brian Trotche. If you ever got Lindy, like, he would get you back tenfold. And Trotch was the same way. If you ever played a joke on Trotch, he would get you back 10 times worse than you got him. So you had to really pick your spot, you know. So I said to Lindy, I said, okay, you got me in a fun way. There was no real reason to get him back. But he was difficult when you tried to play a trick on him. He would always, and usually something ended up on fire when you did something to Lindy. So it was good. He was a great teammate, Mike Ramsey. Guys have been communicating lately. These guys are still in the game. Scott O'Neill, who's the coach in Washington now. Lindy's with the Rangers. Tommy Curvers, who I played with. He actually lived with me for a couple of years in Buffalo. He's now assistant GM in Minnesota, I believe. So we've been through this COVID thing. We've been sending a lot of stuff back and forth just to kind of break up the monotony a little bit. So nice to reacquaint myself with those boys. So.
Clark, did you ever get to experience or see someone experience the 10 times fold wrath of Brian Trotche after someone played a prank on him?
Anything I can actually tell you about?
I don't know.
Yeah. No, there's a couple of things Trotch used to do when we check into the hotel. Him and Bossy were pretty bad. Like, most of the guys would come in and drop their bags off and go and get, you know, a couple of beers, something to eat. Trotch and Boss usually stayed at the hotel and had room service. And I used to wonder why they never went out to eat with any of the guys and stuff. But that was back in the day when you could go. When all the guys would leave, and these guys they went out once in a while, but most of the time they get there, they just stay in the hotel. And I was like, why don't they come and eat with us? You know, what the hell's going on? And that was back in the days when you could go down to the front desk and say, yeah, hi, I'm Clark Gillies. I'm in room 710. I lost my key. Could I get another key? And they just hand you another key, right? So these two assholes would go get guys' keys, and they go up and they do the, you know, the, I can't really say because I don't know what your crowd is, but they would do things in a glass in the bathroom that weren't very pleasant. They would short sheet your bed or do other things in your bed. And then go back to the rooms and think, you know, wait till the guys got back from having something to eat. So we decided, well, Trotch and Boss, two can play that game. So they're out for dinner one night, and I think, I forget who it was, because you used to get Tonelli all the time, and you used to get Borney all the time, and they would get me once in a while, not very serious. And so I think I might have been rooming with either probably Nystrom. He was one of my early roommates. So we went down to the front lobby and got one of their keys, went up, opened up their bed, now we're on a 2-week road trip, and we filled up the bathtub and filled the bathtub with all their clothes. There was nothing left in their suitcases. We put them in the bathtub. And so now they have to deal with dry cleaning and cleaning and this and that. And they're like, hey, who did that to us? And they go, never mind, just stop your shit every time we get into a hotel and maybe that won't happen again. So, but they used to like playing those small little pranks on guys. But he would, yeah, get to the point where, you know, a pair of scissors became very handy to him, and, you know, it would be, you know, no socks, no toes in your socks, one pant leg being a little shorter than the other, you know, tying knots. That was a great one. You go on the road, and guys don't take that many clothes with them. You know, they tend to wear the same suit a few times, a couple different shirts. And the best part was to get a guy's really proud of his brand-new suit, and you would tie it in a knot and pull it as tight as you could get it. And it would sit like that for like an hour and a half when we were out for practice. And then when he came back in, put his suit on, you, in a million years, you couldn't get the wrinkles out of that one leg, right? And we traveled it. We traveled in airports a lot, and it was like people would look at you. I had one of the rookies, they talked him into doing it to me, a guy by the name of Mike Kazicki. I think we had played, I don't know if it was an extended trip from somewhere. We might have been just flying from New York to Los Angeles, and I'm laying there. We had to wear jacket and tie, you know, well, jackets, but, you know, ties, shirt and ties on the plane when we traveled back in those days. So I wake up and everybody's looking at me. All the people are looking at me on the plane. Like, what guy are you looking at? And I look down and my tie had been cut off about halfway down. And I was like, I will find out who did this. I will find out who did this. And so I did a little research and it ended up being he was a rookie, and that's why he did it, because they forced him to do it. He said, you are going to get like shaved or something if you don't cut Clarkie's tie in half. And, you know, there's things that I could physically beat the crap out of him, or I could just torment him for the rest of the year, wondering when I was going to beat the crap out of him or do something really bad to him. So I found out it was Mike Kazicki. So I went over to him with what was left of my tie, and I said, Mike, I don't want you to say anything, but you will pay for this. Not sure how, but you rest assured that you will pay for this before the year is over. And I don't know if I ever did anything to him, but I think he was scared to death for the next 6 months. But those are the kind of things. But I could take a joke. I used to play jokes on guys. I could take a joke. It wasn't that big a deal. But the worst part of that was when I woke up and all the people on the plane were staring at me. What are they looking at? And I was like, okay, somebody's got to pay for this one. Just fun stuff. That was as much fun as anything during my career was being in situations like that. You know, winning was awesome. You know, the four cups, the almost five cups was tremendous. But when I retired, the thing that I missed the most was being in the locker room with the guys every day, laughing, joking. Practices. I used to have so much fun to practice, you know, walking over, skating by some guy and blowing a nostril full of snot on his jersey and, you know, things like that. Oh, sorry, I meant to get that on the ice. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, and crazy stuff, just the crazy fun stuff is what I missed most about when I retired. And just like being with a bunch of your kids all the time, you know, brothers and sisters all the time, brothers all the time, just having fun. And I think most guys say the same thing when they retire from playing hockey, or probably any professional sport, but I think hockey in general, that's what they're going to tell you they miss the most is the hijinks and the fun that they had every single day going to the rink.